that, I call 99-1334 CR State v. Widener. Mr. Balestrieri, Assistant Attorney General representing the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case involves the constitutionality of an application of what is commonly known as the Harmful to Minors Statute, when the material which is deemed harmful to minors is communicated over the Internet.
I'm going to step you right there to ask you a question, which is, do we work under the assumption that this material is ordinarily protected under the First Amendment?
If this material had been distributed to adults, it would be protected,
yes.
That's correct.
So what you have is a distribution to a minor, so it's under less protection, or maybe no protection under the First Amendment.
No protection if it is distributed to a minor. Those are the assumptions.
And is it your position that this statute is constitutional on its face in all instances, or is it your position that it's constitutional at least in this case?
It has already been determined by the Court of Appeals in a case known as State versus Kevin L.C. that this statute is constitutional in all its applications. This particular case involves the specific question of whether or not there may be an exception to the Kevin L.C. rule when the material is distributed over the Internet. That's not a question which was considered in the Kevin L.C. case.
Would it matter if this was a pen pal club where nobody ever saw each other and just communicated by mail? Snail mail instead of Internet?
Mail would be exactly the same as we have in this case. No legal difference.
So any communication that would not be in person. So it could be
let me correct you when you say
right.
In person, because
right.
We think this that was. This is in person.
Okay, and so you would make the same argument about a mail case.
Yes,
mail.
Okay. Right. Right.
Or telegram case.
Or anything where there is not what
fax
I would consider a face-to-face communication.
Fax case. It was all done by the fax machine.
That's right. It would be absolutely the same.
All right, thank you.
And I have a preliminary question also. I'm somewhat confused. Are you addressing this as a constitutional argument as applied or a facial challenge to it?
The circuit, we are the appellant, of course, in this case. This is a certification by the Court of Appeals of an appeal that the state took. As I read the decision of the circuit court in this case, the circuit court found this statute unconstitutional only as applied. And as I read the certification of the Court of Appeals, that's the issue they certified. Again, as I said in answering the Chief Justice's question, the facial constitutionality of the statute has already been addressed in the Kevin L.C. case, and it's been found to be constitutional.
So I guess to really narrow it down, you perceive this as a challenge as applied with respect to the use of the Internet.
That's my understanding of the Circuit Court's decision and what we appealed and what the Court of Appeals considered to be the issue in its certification.
But the defendant is making an argument that the statute is unconstitutional on its face.
Well, I think
the lack of a knowledge requirement as to the age of the minor.
The amicus is making that argument. I don't understand the defendant to be making that argument.
Okay, well, we'll hear from the defense. Anyway, this is a challenge on not face-to-face communication.
Right, and I would just say quite briefly that in terms of addressing the argument of the amicus that this is facially unconstitutional, that was clearly addressed by the United States Supreme Court in the excitement video case, which is the progenitor of all the Wisconsin litigation that's been involved, where the United States Supreme Court clearly enunciated the rule that this exception to the usual rule of scienter when age marks the difference between protected and unprotected conduct applies in the First Amendment context. And that's clearly the ruling in excitement video, and the amicus brief just kind of blithely ignores that decision, blithely ignores Kevin L.C., blithely ignores the United States District Court case on which excitement video was based, and, you know, just kind of goes off on a tangent that's totally unsupported by all of the relevant authority. So I think that clearly, under those authorities, this statute is, in fact, constitutional as applied in almost all contexts, and the only question here is whether the whether in a situation where you don't have face-to-face contact, where the person who is distributing the material does not have a chance to look face-to-face at the recipient, whether under those circumstances, as applied, the statute is not constitutional.
What comes to mind is, and I think of all service statutes that we have, I'm talking about process serving. You can serve in person or by mail. You know, there's, and so those kinds of statutes make a distinction, and by and certainly by implication, if you can serve in person or by mail, it suggests to me that in those statutes, process serving, that mail is not defined as in person. Yet it seems to me fundamental to your argument that we define this email or snail mail as in person. How would you blend that or respond to that concern that I have?
Well, I think that you have a statute which deals with a particular type of situation that simply isn't relevant here. I think when we're talking about Let me backtrack up one step. Whether we call this in-person communication or what other label we put on it is not particularly important. What is important is the substance here. And the substance, as stated in all three of the relevant cases, or all four of the relevant cases, starting with excitement video, is whether or not the person who wishes to disseminate material which is harmful to children has a reasonable opportunity to determine the age of the recipient of the communication. Now, whether you want to call that in-person communication, whether you want to put some different label on it, I don't particularly care. That's not relevant to my argument.
I find this case a difficult case, so I really need assistance on it. When your brief and the summary of argument says, you know, that you need scienter, but there's an exception, however, where the defendant confronts the victim personally. Maybe that's shorthand.
That is a shorthand expression. That's
so
correct.
So you don't really mean personally. You mean
I mean, in a situation where there is an opportunity to reasonably determine age.
That's what you mean.
That's what I mean.
Thank you.
And I would actually go one step further, as I do in my brief, and say that personally is a word which in its ordinary dictionary usage covers that situation. I think it is an accurate single word to determine that phrase that's used in excitement video, Kevin L.C., Zarki, and all of the other cases which stretch this out and expand the concept.
Well, if that's the test, why in Zarki didn't person have an opportunity to determine the age of the recipient? Could have made inquiry.
Zarki dealt with a significantly different situation than we have here.
It was a distributor, right?
Right. It was a distributor of pornographic material.
Right. And he had a First Amendment.
Right.
Right.
So, but the situation was in Zarki that the material was not constitutionally protected and, in fact, illegal because of the age of the person who was depicted in the material, as opposed to this situation where there's a crime because of the age of the person to whom it's distributed. So in Zarki was was a distributor of this material, he never saw the child in person. He never had an opportunity to talk to the child. That's all he had was a picture.
But he could have checked with the producer of this to find out the age of the child.
Maybe, maybe not. Maybe he knew the child. Maybe he knew the producer. This is stuff that's passed down from person to person,
So if it hadn't been passed from person to person, then you would have said that the distributor had a reasonable opportunity to determine the age of the recipient. So Zarnke is...
Well, I would have said that, but you disagreed with me.
Well, but that's my point.
Yeah.
But Zarnke didn't deal with the recipient.
No, Zarnke did not deal with the recipient. Zarnke dealt with a situation where the child, in terms of his contact with Zarnke, was simply a visual depiction. It was not a live person where Zarnke could have talked to that person, communicated with that person, and said, "How old are you?" We didn't have that opportunity. And that's the distinction that the U.S. Supreme Court makes in Excitement Video.
Because Zarnke is of recent origin, and we're talking about the unconstitutionality of the statute. But what you're saying is that because it's one step, and it's a different type of opportunity, the opportunity to ascertain the age, that's the major difference between the Zarnke case and the case we...
Yes, that's an absolutely critical difference.
That's the critical difference.
Right.
Counsel, does it make any difference the opportunity to reliably and reasonably ascertain the age?
Well, that's another big difference. The affirmative defense to this statute expressly says that the question is whether or not the defendant had reasonable cause to believe that the person with whom he was communicating was 18. So this is a reasonable mistake of fact defense. The defendant, in order to avail himself of this defense, does not have to reliably determine age. And indeed, if you look at the United States District Court case, which is a very interesting case on any number of levels, one can never reliably determine age, whether you are communicating over the internet, whether you are communicating face to face.
Are you referring to the Reno case?
I'm referring to United States versus United States District Court. That's the case that involved Tracy Lords, a young lady who made a series of pornographic movies, and all of a sudden they found out that she was only 15 at the time, and so the U.S. Attorney
That's
won.
The Excitement Video.
I'm sorry?
That's the Excitement Video case, isn't it?
No.
No. It's a different case.
It's a different case.
Involving the same Tracy Lords.
Yeah. The U.S. District Court case does involve her. And it was a case where one of the biggest producers of pornography in this country, who had produced some films involving Tracy Lords, made the argument that the federal statute was unconstitutional, the child pornography statute was unconstitutional, because it did not contain this affirmative defense, and the Ninth Circuit read precisely the same kind of affirmative defense that we have into the federal statute and found it constitutional after reading that defense in.
I apologize for the interruption, Justice Bradley.
Yeah, but at any rate, they make quite clear in that case, the Ninth Circuit made quite clear in that case, that you can never be absolutely sure that the person you're dealing with is an adult. Even when you're a big conglomerate, even when you have a plethora of lawyers and others to go out and check on the age of the people who appear in your productions, you can still make mistakes.
Could I ask a question? We have a group of students here. Suppose a person went to their school, didn't see anyone at the school, but left same kind of pictures we have in this case all around the school. And then these students picked them up and brought them here for prosecution. Can that be prosecuted under this statute?
I do not believe that that constitutes a violation under this court's construction of the statute in Thiel, where you said that the statute only applies in a situation where there is a direct transfer of material from the sender or the exhibitor to one or more particular children. This court pretty clearly said in the Thiel case that the statute does not apply in a situation where material is just disseminated broadly to a general audience.
Mr. Bellisberry, are you all done? It seems to me that your basic argument rests upon a fundamental assumption, and that is that the Internet provides a reasonable way to verify the age of the recipient.
That's correct.
I found the Reno case very interesting in that respect, because in the Reno case, Justice Stevens begins by outlining the facts that the government agreed to with the defendant. And among those facts, it says, the district court categorically determined that there is no effective way to determine the identity or the age of a user who is accessing material through email, exploders, etc., chat rooms. Doesn't that pose a huge problem for you?
I think not, because I think the Reno case does not involve the same kind of situation that we're concerned with in this case. As I just pointed out, this statute only applies when there is a one-on-one direct communication between a sender of material and a recipient of material, where they, in fact, are communicating in real time, one-on-one. Reno was concerned with a somewhat different situation, where a person was simply exhibiting material, theoretically, to an entire group in a chat room or on some other part of the Internet. And that was one of the major facets of the case. Reno held the Federal Communications Decency Act unconstitutional for, among other reasons, the fact that you did have a situation in that case where the statute applied in a situation where a communication was sent to a large group of people, and some of whom could have been children, some of whom could have been adults, and the court said that you can't do that because what that does is allows one child in a large group of people to exercise what they call the heckler's veto.
Are you saying that in this case, if Samantha, the 16-year-old, was part of a group that included some 18-year-olds and I disseminated it by an email exploder to this group of 25, of which Samantha was one, I couldn't be prosecuted?
That's correct.
So are you saying, so, wow, that sort of takes me back a bit.
That's what you said in Thiel. I don't know if it was, I don't remember who wrote it, but that's what you as the court collectively said in Thiel.
And that's because it restrains the First Amendment rights to it.
Right. It infringes too much on the rights of adults to obtain this material if one child can prevent adults from obtaining material that is perfectly legal for them to obtain.
Right.
Counsel, what do I do with this? In response to Justice Babbage, you said that your case is based on assumption that Internet is a reasonable way to determine identity. What do I do with my own personal experience? That is, kids, plug your ears. I never give correct identifying information about myself on the Internet. Maybe I have once, but I think I never have. Because I don't want to get this useless email, junk mail, and also out of a sense of privacy. So whether I'm registering on the New York Times webpage, whether it's buyacar.com, whether it's amazon.com, I don't care what it is. You should see all the identities I am, and the locations I am, and the false phone numbers that I am, because I don't want my privacy invaded, and I don't want junk email. So how are you going to convince me that the data is reliable?
I don't have to convince you that the data is reliable, only that it's reasonable.
Well,
only that there's a reasonable opportunity to ask. You did ask, and you then relied.
Made a reasonable determination based on the...
I hear different things. I heard the Chief Justice say reasonable opportunity to ask.
Right.
My response is, you absolutely, unequivocally have a reasonable opportunity to ask on the Internet. But my response is much different if it's reasonable to think the information you're getting is true.
Well, first of all, let me say that we as the state are as much concerned with privacy as you are. We're not interested in having people disseminate all kinds of personal information about themselves over the Internet. And this affirmative defense does not require people to do that. It doesn't require anybody to divulge their true name. It doesn't require anybody to divulge their true address. It doesn't require anybody to divulge their true telephone number. It requires only one thing. You have to divulge your true age. That's it.
So you mean if Samantha here had said she was 18, are you saying that that would have met the affirmative defense?
No.
I didn't think so.
No, because that's not a totally reasonable...
The affirmative defense requires two steps, doesn't it?
Right. It requires some kind of documentation. And this kind of... And what I'm saying in response to Justice Bradley's question is that this documentation does not have to provide all of these personal facts about anybody. It only has to provide information about age. So if you want to use a driver's license, for example, to show someone that you are in fact as old as you say you are, you can take a magic marker and you can cross out everything on that driver's license except the birth date before you send it, and your privacy is completely maintained intact. You can call yourself Joe Schmo if you want. That's okay. Statute doesn't require you, or the statute doesn't require the defendant to learn the true name of the person. All he has to find out is that this someone who calls himself Joe Schmo is in fact 18.
So, play this. I mean, in theory, it sounds good, but play this out in reality to me. How is the defendant going to ascertain and reliable indicia of age?
He doesn't have to. That's okay. My point. He doesn't have to obtain
to
a reliable,
some.
Just reasonable. So if you want a fact situation, let me put it to you this way. What a person has to do to comply with this is just... When he's communicating in the chat room, he says, "Samantha, how old are you?" She says, "I'm 18. He says, "Okay, Samantha, can you send me a copy of your driver's license with everything magic markered out, blacked out, except your picture, so that I can see if you look like someone who's 18, and your birth date, so I can check if you are 18. Samantha sends him something, has a picture on it that looks like somebody who's 18, has a birth date that indicates that the person is 18. That is a reasonable effort to determine age under the circumstances.
Whether it's her driver's license.
Whether it's hers or not.
It doesn't make any difference. Okay.
It doesn't make any difference. That's a reasonable effort to determine age.
It has to have a photo on it.
Well, it would help to have a photo. That's certain.
No. Does it have to have a photo or not? Can I just send the driver's license, everything blacked out other than the birth date?
I think that would probably comply as well.
Well, what kind of notice is this to a defendant? I mean, if I look at the statute, I mean, I, Mr. Balestrieri, you might set up certain conditions, and somebody else might, and a third district attorney might. You know, you might say, well, that was okay to send that, but then some other district attorney might say, no, this doesn't fulfill the requirements of that statute. In terms of notice, and in terms of convenience, and in terms of just verification, it just seems...
Well, this statute uses a standard of reasonableness. That's not a standard which is unknown to the law. We use a standard of reasonableness all the time. Courts deal with it on a daily basis in negligence cases. Courts deal with it on a daily, well, maybe not on a daily basis, but courts deal with it all the time in the context of the criminal law. When you have charged, for example, a negligent homicide, the question is reasonableness. Reasonableness is something that the law uses all the time. Now, maybe some district attorney will differ from another district attorney as to what's a reasonable effort, but that's why we have the courts making decisions in this case, in these kinds of cases. Thank you.
Well, let me just see if I understand the state's position very quickly. The state's position is when there is no person-to-person communication.
Well, what I would call face-to-face communication.
I'm sorry. I meant to use your words. That's right. No face-to-face communication. The accused has a reasonable opportunity to determine the age of the recipient. And if the accused does not do so, then they're guilty under this statute.
Well, let me phrase it this way.
I want to hear you succeed.
Let me phrase it in terms of the way that the affirmative defense... I can't talk a second. That the affirmative defense is phrased in the United States District Court case.
Okay. And that's it. The statute is constitutional as applied with this affirmative defense, is applied where there is no face-to-face communication. That's your position.
Right. It's the defendant meets the affirmative defense if he makes a diligent investigation and forms a reasonable, good faith belief that the person with whom he is communicating is not a child, and you will find that language on page 16 in my brief. That paraphrases the U.S. District Court case.
So that this statute is constitutional as applied, with the affirmative defense on the defendant, even though there is no face-to-face communication.
That would be our position, yes.
That's your position.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Correct.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Phillips, representing Mr. White.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess the first point I want to make relates to what this statute requires and how that relates to the reliability of the age verification. It's true that the statute itself simply requires that the defendant make a reasonable effort to determine the person's age, and although Mr. Balestrieri, I don't think, really mentioned much of this, also produce some sort of official documentation to that the recipient produce some sort of official documentation to support that verification.
It has to be a draft card, driver's license, birth certificate, or other official or apparently official document.
Right.
And that's an and between them.
Right. The defendant has to do both to satisfy the affirmative defense. The problem is that it's the defendant's burden of proof here. And the defendant, when faced with the situation, okay, I'm going to get on the internet and I'm going to send some harmful material out to people I don't know. Assuming the defendant's familiar with the statute, he's going to say, okay, I have to make a reasonable effort to determine the age of the recipient. If I make a mistake on that point, I might get charged with a felony. If I'm unable to convince the jury that I thought this person was an adult, I could end up going to prison. So in that circumstance, what is a speaker supposed to do? Well, he'll try to make the best effort he can, or he'll simply say, I'm afraid I won't be able to convince the jury that I made a reasonable effort. that I had a reasonable belief that this person was an adult, and that I obtained the official documentation that the statute required, I just won't send the material at all. And that's why putting the burden on the defendant infringes the defendant's First Amendment rights. Because if the burden is on the state, he doesn't have to worry that he has to convince the judge.
But he has some reasonable, we're talking about what's reasonable here. You don't think that he has a reasonable expectation, or at least a duty, I hate to use that, but to ascertain that by, and when you say, assuming he knows the law, well, and we all know that we don't know all the law, but there's ignorance is not an excuse.
Oh, exactly. That's not an excuse.
But the point is that you think that that's chilling to the First Amendment to require him to do the minimal, which is...
No. Okay. Perhaps I misspoke on that. Okay. I don't think it's chilling to require him to do the minimal. I think it's chilling to require him to prove to a jury that what he did was reasonable. Among the things that Mr. Balestrieri has suggested that a reasonable effort would include was asking a series of questions to the recipient to determine whether they really are an adult.
I'm somewhat confused. Are you making a challenge to the statute similar to the ACLU's brief?
No, I guess I should clarify this. The challenge as made in the trial court was, quote, as applied to internet communications. Perhaps that was unfortunate terminology, because I don't think this is really an as applied challenge. I think what it is an overbreadth challenge in the particular context of internet communications. In other words, we're not going here to what Mr. Widener did and saying, you know, that his particular actions should have been protected by the First Amendment. We're saying that in all internet communications, this statute is unconstitutional.
Are you saying then that in order to make a statute such as this constitutional in dealing with the internet, the scienter requirement, the burden for the scienter requirement must rest with the state?
Absolutely, and perhaps I can get back to Justice Wilcox's point, because I don't want to be misunderstood that I'm not requiring some sort of reasonable effort on the defendant. This statute could be drafted in a very constitutional way by simply saying that the defendant must know, or reasonably should know, that the person he was dealing with was a child. And in fact, that's how the legislature, after this court invalidated the statute in Zarnke, that's how the legislature fixed that problem. By injecting an objective standard of care into the knowledge requirement, and that's what the defendant
is. All cases, or just the distribution case? Exactly.
They took out the section which included distribution, and there were a number of verbs there, and they said in those situations, if the defendant knew or reasonably should have known that the person was a child, then he's guilty of the offense. And they place the burden on the state to prove that. And that's the difference here.
Knew or should have known.
Right.
Is your view that what particular provisions in B are you objecting to? Is it sell?
Well,
transfer?
Perhaps the difference between this and Zarnke. I don't think you can pull out particular verbs, because you can do any one of those things over the internet. You can sell, exhibit, rent, loan, or transfer over the internet, or through the mail, or through fax, or through telegrams, as Your Honor suggested.
So you're really dealing with no face-to-face communication.
I don't really know if the face-to-face would solve it. I guess I agree with Mr. Balestrieri on that point, is that it's not a face-to-face. We have to get to the substance of what's going on here. And if a defendant if somebody who wants to communicate with harmful material can't reliably know who he's dealing with, he's going to chill his own speech. He's going to refrain from speaking. And by the same token, some recipients, as Justice Bradley had suggested, regarding the invasion of privacy that would be required of recipients in cases like this, some recipients will say, I'm not going to even bother trying to get this material if what I have to do is tell them where I live, how old I am, my height and weight, all of which is on the driver's license, show them my picture. Especially when you're dealing with strangers, and especially when you're dealing with sensitive material, you may not know where this stuff is going to end, where your personal identifying characteristics are going to end up, and whose hands is it going to end up, and what's going to be done with it. When you send it over the internet, there's a permanent record of it. That distinguishes the situation from, you know, when we have to get into a bar or a movie or something like that, where they look at your ID for 2 seconds, those of us who still get carded.
Talking to the right group.
Yeah. well, that's another point. I mean, that's another way that this is different. I think the state suggested in its brief, you know, why does this chill speech when we have all kinds of age verification requirements in society? It doesn't stop people from checking IDs when you buy alcohol or when you buy an R-rated movie or something like that, when you buy cigarettes. Of course, the difference is that in those situations, those purchases are usually made in the presence of the seller, and quite often no identification is required. But most importantly, as to cigarettes and alcohol and so forth, we don't particularly care whether sellers are discouraged from engaging in this activity because it's not First Amendment protected.
Could you explain exactly what it is you hope to come out of this case? Like is the court in a position to read in some sort of scienter requirement, or does it have to rewrite the statute, or what?
Well, I hope to come out of this case with the court invalidating the statute as it did in Zarnke. I think the challenge is the same as it was in Zarnke, really. As you recall, in Zarnke, we didn't get into the specifics of Mr. Zarnke's activity because he probably knew the ages of the children that were involved. We were discussing distributors in general, and I think in this case also we're discussing people who communicate over the internet in general. What I hope to come out of this case with is the statement that the state must prove that the defendant knew or reasonably should have known that the person he was exposing to this material was a child.
What you're trying to achieve, how would that impact on face-to-face communication with a child? Say, invalidate the statute.
Well, in those situations where there was face-to-face communication, it would be extremely easy for the state to satisfy its burden. In the Zarnke case, it would have been easy. In this case, if the state's allegations are true as to what Mr. Widener did, it would be incredibly easy for the state to get a conviction if the statute were constitutional. Now, we don't know if the allegations are true. We've only been through the complaint stage in this case. But
in your view, is the statute constitutional in a face-to-face situation?
No, I would say that the statute is not constitutional because it doesn't place the burden on the state to prove what it should be required to prove. And I know in Zarnke the argument was made that the court could save the statute, and I know, Justice Prosser, that you were the lone justice who felt that it could have been saved. I think for the same reasons that the majority decided that they couldn't do it in Zarnke, we can't do it here either. For one thing, it would require inserting into the elements of the offense something which the legislature has specifically indicated that they did not intend to be an element. They couldn't make it more clear. Making this an affirmative defense and specifically saying the defendant bears the burden of raising and proving the defense. It's obvious the legislature has considered this and rejected it. And that being the case, it's a different situation, in other words, from excitement video and Reno, where, well, I guess the knowledge of age wasn't really critical in Reno, but in excitement video, the statute simply said it already included it knowingly, I believe, in the definition of the crime, and then it had a number of words that followed. And the question was, well, does the knowingly modify all of these words or just some of them? Well, we don't have that here. The legislature made it perfectly clear that the only knowledge element relates to the nature of the material itself.
So when Mr. opposing counsel indicated that what he thought the difference between Zarnke and the Whitehair case is basically because it's one-on-one, and it's an opportunity to ascertain the age, you're saying no, that the legislature would have to come back and change the statute as they did in Zarnke to say basically because they have to place the burden of scienter on the state.
Yes.
And that's the crux of your
yes, argument. Right. That's the only way to make the statute constitutional is to place the burden on the state.
Regardless of if the person on a face-to-face, so you...
Right. Yeah. The difference is the reason that in some cases personal confrontation or face-to-face, whatever, is sufficient to do away with that requirement is that there are no First Amendment values that are being protected. The original situation was the Morissette footnote, which referred to statutory rape. And in that situation, obviously you don't have any First Amendment right to engage in sexual intercourse with a minor or with anyone else for that matter. So eliminating the knowledge requirement in that situation doesn't infringe on First Amendment values.
Now, you say that the only way to make the statute constitutional is to place the burden on the state to prove scienter. Does that necessarily mean that we have to overrule Kevin L.C.?
I believe it does. I think the problem with Kevin L.C. is that they never anticipated this situation, because the court in Kevin L.C. just made a blanket statement to the effect that, well, sells, exhibits, loans, transfers, rents. That involves personal confrontation.
But can't Kevin L.C. be distinguished on the grounds that this was a face-to-face with
certainly
an obvious minor, and therefore the statute is constitutional with respect to that defendant?
Well, as applied to that defendant, I guess, true. I think the challenge in Kevin L.C. was to its spatial validity also. So it didn't matter what Kevin L.C. had done either. But in both Kevin L.C. and Field, the two cases that have addressed the statute before, we were dealing with face-to-face exposure of children, which is perhaps why no one has ever thought of, well, you know, really this statute applies to more than just face-to-face selling and exhibiting and so forth. And it's in these other situations where you run into problems. If the only way you could do this was in a face-to-face confrontation or interaction, perhaps we wouldn't have the same problems, because it would be rare that any person exposing a child to this material would be thinking, geez, I might not be able to prove to a jury that I reasonably thought this person was an adult. I mean, in Kevin L.C., I think the guy was dealing with his niece and his son.
Well, what if we were to hold here that this statute was unconstitutional as it relates to internet transactions? Would you be satisfied?
Yes, I would be satisfied. There's a difference between representing my own client and expressing a view as to how the statute could be written.
Well, what I'm asking, I guess, is can we save the statute with respect to the Thiel and the Kevin L. situation?
I don't think so. And the reason I say that is because you have to write into the statute words that the legislature clearly intended not be there.
I mean, your argument is just essentially the exact same argument as in Zarnke and the exact same argument as in Kevin L.C., which is that this statute is unconstitutional on its face because it does not contain a requirement that the state prove that the defendant knew the victim was underage. And the internet overtones of this case simply illustrate why that's a problem under excitement video, right? But you want the statute struck down. You want us to tell the legislature, rewrite it just like you did in the Zarnke case.
I think that would be the best way to deal with it, yes. It's not necessary to take that extreme position in order to provide relief to Mr. Wagner.
Well,
I mean, that's my
we're
position.
Not concerned about Mr. Wagner.
Well, I realize that. I'm advocating in behalf of Mr. Wagner. I believe the statute is unconstitutional in the particular context of internet communications. That was the challenge that was brought in the trial court. And as to, how it would apply in other situations, mail and so forth.
How would you distinguish mail?
Pardon me?
How would you distinguish any other no face-to-face communication?
I think mail is very similar. You don't often exchange through the mail communications with people you don't know unless it's in a commercial setting, I suppose. But I think this statute, I think it would apply to Amazon.com. If they're sending books out with pictures of nudes in them, for instance, and people that are children, I don't see any reason why they could not be prosecuted. I think the court has to consider the effect that this statute could possibly have on internet commerce, because right now I would assume that very little is being done by the commercial entrepreneurs to verify age. And maybe they're not aware of this statute, but I see no reason why it would not apply to them just as it applies to Mr. Wagner.
Why, given the majority opinion in Zarnke, is there any way that this court can, from your perspective, legitimately say, well, we're just going to save the statute and read in the scienter requirement?
Not in light of the fact that they made, I guess if the legislature had been silent on the knowledge question altogether and not made it an affirmative defense, then I guess you could, the court has done that in the past where the statute is silent. They've inserted, I believe in Kolova, the operating after revocation case. The court inserted the knowledge requirement, and that's another example, by the way, of the knowledge requirement was an objective one that the court inserted. Knew or should have known that he was revoked. in that situation, the legislature had been silent, and the court inferred, well, they must interpret the statute for it to be constitutional. The legislature must have intended to draft a constitutional statute. But here it's obvious that the legislature did not intend to make knowledge an element of the state's burden. They intended the defendant to have to prove it. And you'd have to completely sever the affirmative defense section, strike that out, and then, depending on how far the court was willing to go, in terms of under what circumstances the state had the burden, it would have to insert some sort of language about the circumstances where knowledge had to be proven by the state. And that's an appropriate job for the legislature, quite honestly.
I guess I'm still confused as to what it is you're asking for. Are you asking us to say that because of the inherent difficulties, if not impossibilities, of identifying the age of a recipient over the internet, the statute is unconstitutional as applied to the internet situation?
Yes, yes. Yes, that is the best example of where it is unconstitutional as applied, because it places the burden on the defendant, because the defendant will fear that he won't be able to meet that burden and will refrain from speaking. And because recipients will not wish the inconvenience and the invasion of privacy to engage in communication which they have a right to receive. I want to address another point that I disagree with Mr. Balistrieri on. I believe Justice Prosser had asked the question, or perhaps it was Justice Babich, if you go into a school and you place harmful material in a school, I think there's several different possible scenarios. I think if you walk into a school and leave a pile of leaflets in the school and walk out, that might be the situation that the court was talking about in Thiel, where it said, distinct from those cases involving the commercial display of materials to a general consumer audience, the language of Section 948.11 focuses upon the affirmative conduct of an individual toward a specific minor or minors. Arguably, in that situation, you're not giving it to a specific minor or minors. But if there's a pep rally or something, and you're standing at the door, and you see 100 kids come in, and you place on the, right as they're coming in, you place on the table, take one, these leaflets of harmful material, that's a completely different situation, because you're going beyond making the stuff available to a general consumer audience. The statute doesn't just address one-on-one communication. The Field case talks about a specific minor or minors. I think in the internet situation, the best way to look at this is if you have a website and you post harmful material on a website available to anyone who happens to find the website, that's probably covered under Thiel. You wouldn't be convicted of the offense if a child happened to get the material. But if you went into a bulletin board group or interest group or chat room or any place where you knew that a minor was there, or where a minor identified himself, or where just a specific minor is in the group, and you disseminate that material to the specific minor, that is a violation of the statute, and I disagree with the state on this. I think it is very clearly a violation that Thiel would not excuse. I see that my time is just about up. I think I've frankly covered the points that I wanted to cover, unless the court has any other questions.
Could you respond a little bit more? The underpinning of your argument is that it's so difficult to verify the age. The Attorney General responds by saying, no, it's not. I'd like to hear your response as to why the Attorney General is wrong.
Oh, well, as I hear the Attorney General, they're saying it doesn't make any difference whether you can reliably determine the age, because all the affirmative defense requires is that you make a reasonable effort. That's right. That's all the statute requires. But when the burden is on the defendant, the defendant will look at it like, I can't afford to screw this up. I can't afford to make a mistake here. I don't know who I'm dealing with. I'm dealing with Justice Bradley, who uses a different name every time she goes on the internet. I'm dealing with somebody who is willing to send me their driver's license, but blackens out everything on there but age. I don't have the slightest idea who I'm dealing with here. If the jury doesn't buy my defense that I made a reasonable effort, you know, maybe some district attorney will argue, as Mr. Balestrieri did in his brief, that you've got to ask questions of the recipient to determine whether they're an adult or a child. You know, maybe you ask them, where were you when Reagan was shot or something. I don't know what you ask them. But if the DA makes that argument and the defendant isn't able to counter it, he goes to prison. And that's what defendants will fear. And because of that, because they know they can't reliably determine the age of the person they're dealing with, they won't engage in the communication at all.
Can I ask once more? You want to invalidate the statute as it would be applied in an internet prosecution. But can we do that without and still have an intact statute?
Well, I don't know. I guess that gets back to Justice Abrahamson's question about, don't all of these verbs, can't all of them be used in the internet context? I think it's much more difficult to separate out the internet communications from the other types of communications, like was done in Zarnke. There it was, it was much easier to distinguish between a distributor and a producer and a performer, for example. In this situation, you know, all of the verb forms apply in the internet context. So I don't know how the court could suggest that, well, part of the statute is okay, so you can leave these words in, but you have to strike these other words. Because what really has to be done is you have to add words to say, well, in internet communications, the state has to bear the burden of proof. But like I say,
Counsel, this gets to our grappling of what is really being said. As I hear you really saying this, you are facially challenging the statute on grounds of overbreath because it chills protected speech. That's what I hear you
yes.
saying. And that perhaps in Kevin L.C., the statute, it was perhaps declared facially constitutional, but that we have another reality in our lives now, and when the statute is read with the reality of internet, that the statute is facially overbroad and chills.
Exactly, because I don't think the court ever considered the internet in Kevin L.C. or in Thiel, and it had no reason to. Even though those were facial challenges, they still weren't brought in a context that made the court think about other types of communication. I mean, they were brought up in cases where there was a, see this type of thing. And I think the court just glossed over the fact that these verb forms don't just apply to, you know, that face-to-face situation. There are a number of other possibilities that for disseminating material besides what was done in Kevin L. C. and in Thiel. And it's these other situations that create the constitutional problems.
So in those cases, the statute is constitutional as applied.
Right.
Because there was face-to-face communication.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Balasferri.
When the amicus filed its brief in this case, I asked for an opportunity to file a supplemental brief addressing the issue that the amicus had raised, and my motion was denied. If this court is now going to consider the question raised by the amicus, which is whether this statute is unconstitutional on its face, I would like the court to reconsider that decision and allow me to file a brief addressing the issue that this court is going to decide in this case.
What about Mr. Phillips's argument about overbreadth and that it shows speech no face-to-face communication?
Well, first of all, I will point out that that argument has, in fact, already been addressed by the United States District Court case. And the Ninth Circuit in that case decided specifically that where you had an affirmative defense of reasonable mistake of age, that gave to the person who wanted to disseminate material harmful to children, pornographic material in that case.
That's a 1988 case, right? And it's Ninth Circuit. That doesn't bind us.
No, of course it doesn't bind you.
All right. So.
But it's certainly persuasive, since it's one of the few cases dealing with the issue. I will also point out, as I did in my reply brief, that there are a few cases in this country, and I've cited a couple of them, which have gone even farther and have held that even when you don't have an affirmative defense, even when you have strict liability, there is sufficient breathing room, that that's not violative of the First Amendment.
Which are those?
There are two. I can't recall the names of them. I cited them in my reply brief. I cited a federal case and a Maryland case.
Because this is a very important threshold issue here. I mean, the crux of the defendant's whole argument depends upon the premise that you need to have the state prove knowledge of the victim's age in order to have a constitutional statute.
Well,
the fact that you can't in an internet context is the whole problem here. I mean, that's the threshold question. So whether you can or cannot constitutionally have strict liability in this field is the threshold question that we have to answer face-to-face.
No, because this is not a strict liability statute. That's another point that was made in the ACLU brief that's absolutely wrong. This is not a strict liability statute. And I will refer you to Lefebvre's text on substantive
it's
criminal
law. Not a strict liability case statute because there is a defense of that.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. Where there is an affirmative defense, it is not a strict liability statute.
Affirmative defense that the defendant has to prove.
That's right. The affirmative defense that the defendant has to prove takes it out of the realm of being a strict
right.
liability.
So it's
statute.
Not pure strict liability in the way that a child sexual assault is.
That's correct.
Because there is the affirmative defense. But can you have this form? I mean, it's a species of strict liability because the burden is on the defendant to prove the affirmative defense.
No, it's not a species of strict liability. A strict liability offense is one where knowledge would not be relevant to determining guilt or innocence. In this case, knowledge is relevant to determining guilt or innocence. The only thing is, in this case, that we require the defendant to prove lack of knowledge as an affirmative defense instead of the state proving knowledge as an element of the offense. But knowledge is a relevant factual consideration, and that makes this not a strict liability
offense. But the defendant's argument is that it really is a strict liability offense because in the internet context, the defendant can never prove that defense.
Well, that's...
I mean, isn't that another way of saying what their ultimate argument is?
I'm... You know, I thought I understood their argument before I came in here today, and frankly, after listening to the public defender's argument, I don't know what their position is. I really don't.
Let me tell you what our position might be, and I'm going to follow along with what Justice Sykes said. The affirmative defense in 2C is that the defendant had reasonable cause to believe that the defendant had attained the age of 18. Had it stopped there, that would have been, in effect, what you were arguing, that you could get reasonable cause to believe that the person was 18 by asking and then getting some kind of facts or information of a limited amount from the driver's license. But it goes on. And the child exhibited to the defendant a draft card, driver's license, birth certificate, or other official or apparently official document purporting to establish that the child has attained the age of 18. That is a significant requirement to show that you've made reasonable effort to the extent of getting something official.
Well, that depends on how you define official. If you define official as governmental, then maybe. Official, however, if you look at the dictionary definition of official, official does not necessarily mean governmental. And the way I read this requirement in the affirmative defense is that it simply means that the recipient of the material has to display some kind of neutral third-party verification of age. That does not have to be governmental. I'm sorry?
My mother, a little note from the school teacher saying I'm 18.
Someone
satisfying.
Someone who's in a position to know. And in particular, let me also address something else that Mr. Phillips said when he was talking about commercial distributors. Commercial distributors, in fact, do check ages before they send things to someone. There's a service called Adult Check. It's one word in quotation marks that distributors of sexually oriented material use to determine the age of the recipient. They're pretty concerned about this on a national level. So what we have is these third, this is a corporation, a company that verifies ages of recipients. It's a third party, it's not a governmental agency, it's a private agency, but it would certainly qualify under the circumstances in this affirmative defense.
So that's what you'd expect this defendant to do on the internet, that if they can't get a driver's license, draft card, birth certificate, that they should use a commercial
verification
check, verification
service.
And you don't think that that stifles the First Amendment rights too much?
Well, everybody has some form of identification. An adult would almost certainly have a driver's license, or in this state, an official Wisconsin identification card. I don't think that's a problem. It's not a significant enough problem to invalidate this statute. And I would point this court to the decision of the United States Supreme Court in Smith versus California that I cite, which says that in order to invalidate a statute on First Amendment grounds because of a chilling effect, there has to be a substantial chilling effect, because any statute that deals with communication is going to have some chilling effect.
Now, let me just raise this question to you. What is it about the non-party brief, the ACLU brief, that concerns you that is different from the defendant's brief? Is it that we'll declare the entire statute unconstitutional?
Yes.
All of its ramifications?
As I read the defendant's brief, it is limited to the issue which is presented in this case, and that is unconstitutional as applied. The ACLU brief says it's unconstitutional on its face.
Okay.
But the brief of the public defender very early on talks about overbreadth.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's beginning on page 4 or something. It says that. I'll find it.
But only overbreadth in the sense that it's overly broad in terms of as it applies to communication over the internet.
As it applies to internet communication.
Right. Not as it applies to face-to-face, mano-a-mano type communications.
Who has the burden then? Normally, if you're challenging something as a defendant, you've got to prove this unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. Good luck. But if you're talking about First Amendment overbreadth challenges, generally the rule is state.
Well, the rule in this court is that the state has the burden.
Yeah, so who has the burden for overbreadth as applied to the Internet?
Well, I think we have the burden.
To show it's constitutional.
To show it's constitutional. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ballasberry. Thank you, Mr. Phillips. That ends our hearing on 99-1334 CR. And
thank you.